staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers.
Give me 2 eggs. So tomorrow I got nothing.
I really believe that everybody should be born poor. 1 week of their life. 1 week.
As you see, I'm in a wheelchair. I was hit by a train 10 years ago. And a year ago, I was hit by a truck.
There's a feeling in the pit of your stomach the first several nights that you're out there when you realize you actually are in a place where you got nowhere to go.
How do you like being at the shelter?
Kind of good. And I like it when we had our own bed, different. And when we get our new house, I'll be so happy when I have my own room.
This may surprise a lot of people, but in the last school year, all of our schools here in Butte County, there's 14 different school districts, identified about 900 students, children and youth who were in homeless situations during the course of the school year.
Welcome to the Without a Roof program, where we expose and remedy poverty, the worst form of violence. Guillermo Mash here for the June 23rd Without a Roof Radio program. I'm going to do a lead-in for an interview here that's coming up right after this for Sharice Allen, the coordinator for the recently completed and published 2017 HUD Continuum of Care Homeless Point in Time Count and Survey. But I want to read the executive summary, about half of the page with the bullets. The community point in time offers these highlighted findings. 1,983 individuals experiencing homelessness were part of 1,583 households, 85% of which were made up of adults only. Another 8% were family households, and 6% were households of minor unaccompanied youth. Count by community. Chico had the highest count at 1,096 individuals, a 92% increase since 2015. Orville had the second highest count with 713 people, an 83% increase. Paradise count increased to 120 people, a 145% increase, and almost an evenly split between Paradise and Magalia. Gridley saw a decrease of 8 people to 26, or a 22% decrease. Residency. The survey data shows that more than 3/4 of the adults and unaccompanied youth had lived in Butte County for more than 3 years. More than half of those surveyed had lived in the county over 10 years. Almost 80% were living in Butte County when they became homeless, and nearly 90% confirmed that Butte County is their home. Those not originally from Butte County moved to the county for reasons analogous to those not in a homeless situation, such as family, college, quality of life, job opportunities, etc. Chronic homelessness. Nearly half, 47% of the individuals, 929, met the definition of chronically homeless, which is a combination of time spent homeless and the existence of a disabling condition, implying that individuals and families are remaining homeless for long periods of time and doing so while trying to manage persistent physical, mental, or developmental conditions. All right, that executive summary, as well as the entirety of the 2017 Butte County Homeless Point in Time and Survey, and prior years, all the way back to 2009, at buttehomelesscoc.com. After the Sharice Allen interview, stay tuned for Brad Montgomery in an interview around his 8-year tenure as executive director at the Torres Community Shelter, a homeless shelter here in Chico, California. And thank you for being a listener, contributor, supporter of KZFR 90.1 FM, People Power Radio. All right, this is Guillermo Mash for the June 21st Without a Roof Radio program. And it's my real pleasure to have on a pre-record Sharice Allen, who was the project coordinator for the recent HUD biannual, every other year, Homeless Point in Time and Survey. And she's going to help us go through some of her findings, the team's findings from that. So welcome to KZFR, Sharice Allen.
Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me.
So let's just start off with the process for creating the count in the survey, Sharice.
Well, the survey, the primary purpose of it is to have a count of the number of people that are experiencing homelessness in the county, which is a huge undertaking. There's a lot of things that can happen on that one 24-hour period of time, and we spend months anticipating, you know, everything that might happen and being prepared. We were incredibly fortunate this time in 2017 to have a steering committee that was very diverse, working within the community in a number of different ways, and they really took on a piece of the project that was within their expertise. So whether it was an unsheltered count, or they're representing Oroville, or behavioral health, or whatever, they really came together, that steering committee, to develop a plan and a methodology that turned out to be really effective.
So what were maybe some of the changes? I know we touched upon it briefly at your council session yesterday, but what were some of maybe the major one or two differences between how it was executed this year versus 2015?
Well, you know, as I mentioned in the council meeting, we actually took the debrief from 2015 and we implemented about 50 improvements that had been identified in that debrief. So I'm really proud about that. It was the first thing we did was go back and look at the changes we want to make. It is a continual process of improvement. Our county is no different than any others in that we want to do it better. But some of the things that were great improvements was really the number of community members that came out to support that. The training that those community members received, we had one person train everyone on how to administer the survey. So the surveys were very, very clean compared to 2015. The information that we received was much more complete. So that was really helpful in analyzing the information later. We did have a PIT coordinator just to keep, you know, everything in motion. I mentioned that steering committee was stellar. Our survey, I think, dramatically improved from the years prior. It's hard to know where to start with that survey because while we have, you know, someone in front of us that we want to learn about in order to solve this problem, it's hard to know when we actually, you know, how many questions to ask, when it becomes just an invasive process and when we're still getting information that we can look at them in the eye and say, yeah, we're going to use this information to improve your situation. So we had to kind of strike a balance with that. We improved the number of locations, the type of volunteers. We had it. Behavioral health came out in an amazing way with so many professional volunteers that allowed us to go into encampments. And we had the support of the healthcare system in a new way we've never had before, all the hospitals participating. Law enforcement helped. And we still kept with that great youth count. And then we also hired who we called navigators, or people that were experiencing homelessness, to help us understand how best to execute the methodology so that we were being respectful and we were insightful on how we move forward with our planning and on the day of the event.
So yeah, it's kind of a fun backstory because in 2015, I was out in front of the Shalom Clinic thrift store. We did some surveys there, but then someone that was actually staying in the Sabbath house came by and said, hey, why don't we go out? And I know a lot of these different people in these different areas, and we literally went out and executed the survey, kind of like you just described, navigators, because they know the community and they know where to go. I had a really hard time with that with the 2015. I talked to a lot of people offline about it, but it was, anyway, the way the survey was designed and the way the questions were positioned, it was very frustrating for this, a lot of the people that took it and for me to administer it. So, you know, I know I had you on about 4 or 5 months ago, and I had a chance to see the survey, and I just want to commend the whole team because I thought it really addressed a lot of the things I saw in 2015. So I was really pleased for that. And I'm pleased to have so many more people involved in a consistent training too, because I thought in 2015 we definitely could have used more people. So I appreciate it to all the folks that were involved in that, including you, Charisse.
Yeah, thank you. And I'll pass that on to the rest of the team. Yeah, the survey's always tricky. I thought that we'd be done in one meeting, and it went on for months to make sure that it was the best survey that we could make it. And we still, you know, the day after the pit, I sat down and started making notes on things I would have changed. So, you know, we'll continually try to improve. I think that that's just, you know, what we need to do in life and what we need to do in this study every other year, too.
What were your personal, you know, because I know a lot of people have heard their takeaways from the survey. I mean, if you were to kind of detach yourself from your role of kind of gathering all the data and consolidating it, what were your takeaways, Charisse?
One of my big takeaways is the power of community. I know this can be kind of a divisive subject, homelessness, and I'm always completely blown away by our amazing community. I mean, the fact that people that are housed come together to try to come up with some solutions and do whatever they can to improve the situation. The people that are unhoused in our community that are so generous with their information and trusting that we are going to do something to improve our community at large, that ends up being, you know, just my biggest takeaway. It actually gives me the energy when I'm tired with big projects like this to feel like the community is coming together and there's something really impactful that's happening with my energy. So that is always my biggest takeaway. I really love what I do.
Yeah, that makes me give a shout out too for the people that took the survey, because, you know, they ask a lot of personal questions, and, you know, a lot of times you're in a space that might be crowded, like the Jesus Center or something like that. And, you know, it is a really big help. And all the surveys I've done over the past couple, I didn't do this one, the people are not only really helpful, but in many regards, it helps validate their situation. You know, you're kind of talking through the survey and you're getting to know the person. That's what's kind of fun, I thought, was good about all the surveys, whether I thought they were well executed or not. It gave you an opportunity to kind of connect with the person that you're interviewing. So,
right. You know, I ran around a little bit that day, but it's definitely what I saw were those relationships, the one-to-one conversations that are just so powerful. I hope that we have more volunteers that can experience that.
Just to make sure the listeners know, we're talking with Cherise Allen, the homeless point in time coordinator. But every single survey had a one-on-one. You had someone that was trained to administer the survey, and they were physically reading the questions. Because I think there may be a little bit of a misconception, or people would jump to the conclusion that you handed this paper to someone and they turned it back in. But you had trained people that were physically there one-on-one with the folks that took the survey.
Absolutely. We wouldn't want it any other way for many reasons. One, it's respectful to talk one-on-one. The first thing we do is we introduce ourselves so that they know who we are, and we're talking to them as a person to a person. I mean, it seems somewhat obvious, but it also helps, you know, with literacy levels or language barriers or other mm-hmm. issues that may be there too.
So what are some of the most common questions and comments you're getting, Cherise?
You know, we're getting a lot of questions about the number of surveys gathered in 2017 compared to 2015, and I want to continue to say that, you know, we don't know conclusively why there's such a big jump. And rather than getting bogged down in that, I'd rather us focus on the fact that we have, you know, 1,983 people in our county that are without stable housing, to focus on that, because that we know to be true. That is the minimum number. We know that there are likely more, but that's enough for us to take on, and so we can just go ahead and focus on that. That is probably the biggest question. There's so much information, and I think people are still really going through that and trying to figure out where we go from here. So at this point, we're just looking mostly at the count.
Yeah, that's some powerful words around, you know, how to use the survey data. I think one of the analogies you said, you know, you need to be careful taking, you know, something on page one and combining it with page three and think you've come up with a new data point. Maybe you could explain a little bit on how people could use the survey and how to find it.
When we write the report, we have to be extremely careful on how we're representing the data. We want it to be represented in a way that is valid, and we want to maintain that credibility. So as we look at the information in the study, if there is a question about, you know, if we can turn a number into a percent, or if we can compare one number on one page to another number on another page, it may be helpful to stick with whatever's in the report or contact me, because there may be a reason that it's reported the way that it was. For example, you know, you may want to look at the number of individuals that reported having a mental health condition and then take that as a percentage for the whole, using the whole number, the whole count. But not every person who completed the survey answered that question. The children didn't answer that question, and often spouses that were on the same form or partners didn't answer that question. So you can't really take that number with the full population and come up with a percent of the people that completed the survey who said that they had a mental health condition. I would need to use a different number, which would make that percent much higher. So I just want us to be careful about drawing conclusions from one piece of the information to, you know, study to another piece. I want to make sure it's as valid and reliable as it can be, so that we're all working with same information. That's the point, to make sure that we're all using the same language and the same facts to make our choices of where we go from here.
So Cherise, I know there's a lot of data in that report, and I really wanted to hear from you, you know, the data that you thought was most important for our listeners on KZFR to hear regarding the 2017 Homeless Point in Time and Survey.
Well, that's a tricky question. There is a lot of information in there, and for your listeners, if they pull up the report, there is an executive summary that kind of covers many, many topics, and so please feel free to do that. One of the pieces of information I thought was interesting was just the number of people in different living circumstances. We had almost 750 individuals that were unsheltered on the 9 of the pit, and we had another 350 that were in emergency shelters, another 37 that were in emergency hotel vouchers. But those 750 unsheltered and 350 in emergency shelters, what struck me was that other than Catalyst, those individuals vacate their living situation during the day. So we're looking at over 1,000 people that don't have a day program that has services available to them, is acclimated to the temperature that is healthiest, et cetera, that we just don't have that day program for those individuals. So when we look around our towns and we see people that are on the street, you know, one of the reasons that's the case is that there's no place else for these individuals to go. So that was something that was surprising to me, but it really hit home. The other was that we have such a high number of people who are considered chronically homeless, which is a combination of the length of time that they've been homeless and the existence of a disabling condition. And we're looking at half of the people that are without stable housing are actually chronically homeless, that they've been homeless well over a year and have a disabling condition. And even our youth are not free from that, that we have our transition age youth that are 18 to 24 year olds, that I believe it was 30% of those young individuals are already meeting the definition of chronically homeless. So this is an issue of not being able to remedy the situation that they are homeless and we aren't able to move them into housing. And of course that brings up the big subject of adequate housing, adequate affordable housing in Butte County. So that was telling to me, is everything seemed to point back to affordable housing. When we asked what the biggest barriers were to ending homelessness, the number one barrier by far was finding affordable housing.
Yeah, nothing ends homelessness like a home.
Right. And what we need is such diversity in housing. We need affordable housing that's for families, for singles. We just need a variety of types. We need a harm reduction shelter, supportive housing. We need housing for those high-frequency users of hospital services and law enforcement time. We need master lease programs, emergency bridge housing. We just need housing options for individuals, and we just need to increase that housing stock in order to end homelessness in our county.
And the emergency shelter stock, too, because we're nowhere near where we need to be. I mean, it's just amazing to me. You know, and I know a fair amount of folks experiencing homelessness, and a lot of them that are chronic. I can tell immediately when I see them whether they're housed. You know, I look and I go, how you doing? You inside? Yep. I can tell before I ask the question. It is such a devastating thing, being forced to live on the streets.
Yeah, I was over at the new housing project that Behavioral Health shepherded, and there was an individual there. We were touring the apartments, and he said to me, yeah, I've been sheltered for a few days. I'm already feeling healthier. I already feel like I can contribute again. And I was like, that's what I hear time and time again. Just getting that shelter and that stability, all of a sudden people start to heal. They feel stronger. They're able to get the services they need. So that first step of sheltering is so important.
Any closing comments, Cherie? Something we might want to circle back on? Something that you want to add to the conversation?
You know, I just want to thank the community again, both the housed and unhoused community, for participating in this project, for the continuum of care that initiates the project, to Butte County Department of Behavioral Health and the City of Chico that actually funded the project, along with the Housing Authority, County of Butte. I mean, those three entities invested in this process, and I think that's one of the reasons it was so effective, is it had some funding behind it so that we could actually do what we needed to do to get a really good count. So I just want to thank everybody for their participation. It took probably 3,000 people or so to make this all happen, whether they were housed or unhoused, and so just really proud of our community for the effort.
Maybe I'll do a closing comment, because when I heard the word funding, HUD does this for many reasons, but maybe the biggest one is they look at areas of funding. So this should, in many theories and practice, increase the amount of funding that we get in the county for services over the next couple of years. Is that an accurate representation of the service?
Yes, absolutely. That the numbers that are entered into the HUD database are used to determine whether we are eligible for certain funding sources, and comparing the number to other continuum of care in other counties. Absolutely. And this project is done without any funding from HUD. So it's required, but although they don't offer any funding for that. So we have to have an upfront community investment to get the numbers that are as accurate as we can have them in order to secure funding. So it really, again, goes back to grassroots and what our community does to invest in our community to end homelessness.
All right, Cherise Allen, thanks so much for joining KZFR 90.1 FM.
All right, thanks, Bill.
Okay, for folks accessing that report online, you want to go to buttehomelesscoc.com. COC stands for Continuum of Care, and you'll find a landing page that has the point in times for this year going all the way back to 2009. Without a Roof Radio program is made possible by generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Vitamin Fox, providing a large selection of traditional Chinese medicinal formulas, nutraceuticals, antioxidants, and enzymes combined with acupuncture and personalized service. The Vitamin Fox also carries high-quality, safe, legal, over-the-counter CBD oil, too. Founded in 2006, the Vitamin Fox is located 1224 Mangrove. It's on Facebook. It can be reached by calling 345-9685. All right, Guillermo Mash here with Brad Montgomery, the executive director of the Torres Community Shelter here in Chico, California. And welcome to KZFR, Brad Montgomery.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's always nice having you on. I know there's been a milestone for you. You're moving on from your position. Maybe you can let our listeners know a little bit about that and any plans you may have.
Sure. I gave my notice last week. I've been here 8 years. July 12th will be my last day here, and I don't have any plans. People obviously are curious, and she goes great down, but almost everybody is asking, so what's the backstory? There really isn't a backstory. 8 years is a long time. I think this is the type of job that if you're going to do it well, it's going to consume you. Every time I've tried to have a little bit more balance, and I hear people say you ought to have a good balance in life, et cetera. Anytime I've tried to do that, my performance here has suffered, and I haven't felt like I'm doing what I should be doing. And so after 8 years of great memories, fantastic people, being able to help a lot of people and taking an awful lot of pride in that, at the same time, sometimes you just know it. It's time. It's at that point where I just want to take some time and decompress and figure out what I want to do next.
I really feel for that, Brad, because I've taken some steps back myself because it can be very, very stressful, man. Working with folks that are really in desperate need without enough help out there to help them. That's the thing that really gets me. Yeah,
that's definitely part of a challenge. That I try to build bridges with people. I hope I've been successful with that. I haven't always been successful, I know that. But it seems like in so many ways we're still having a conversation about whether or not people are worth saving instead of a conversation about what's the most effective ways to do it. And let's implement as many ways as possible because different things work for different people.
Yeah, we have the latest point in time, 1983. That's the count that we came up with, and it's a devastating number. Any comments around this point in time survey? We just had Cherise Allen on.
I feel that this count is a really good baseline going forward. Back in the 2015 count, I don't think we had enough people or the right methodology to get a better sense. People kept asking Cherise if it was an accurate count. Well, it's not like our math was bad, but that's how many people we found.
Right.
In 2015. We can't add. So it was kind of awkward for her to answer, but at the same time, the count that we had was accurate for the people we met, but I never believed that it was an accurate depiction of how many people were encountering homelessness in 2015, and I was even, I think, on your radio show, among other places, saying I didn't believe that the count was reflective of the problem, and I didn't think it had gone down. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the trend, that 1 year is kind of an outlier in what the trend has been.
Yeah.
So I think the chiefs and the 300 volunteers that helped, including myself, including you, you were part of it, right?
Not this year. The past two, other than promoting it.
Well,
I guess that's a big part of it.
2015 was your fault, though.
Yeah, it was exactly, Brad. The cat's out of the bag.
Yeah, now we know. I think she and the team did a great job this year, and I think this is a good baseline to work from and much more reflective of reality.
So how have the dynamics of homelessness changed these past 8 years from your view as the director of the local homeless shelter here in Chico, California?
Well, you do remember that I came on just a few months after the housing bubble burst, after the stock market crashed. And one of the things that I said, and I think it was quoted in some papers saying this, but I know I said it to volunteers, staff, board members, was that the work that we were doing will always get some people motivated. Some people are going to want to help. Some people are going to want to get involved. But there would be a tapering off as the economy got better. I mean, during that stage, it was like, well, everybody understands why people might have just become homeless because of what just happened. And there was much more of an outpouring of genuine understanding and sympathy. And then over time, that does dry up a little bit, not by all people, not by a stretch of the imagination, but it does start to, after a while, when supposedly the economy gets better, which has always just been numbers and a graph to me that don't seem to really reflect people I know's lives getting better,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
It does to me, yeah.
Then some of the support is not as easy to come by. And I've been, you know, watching that be one of the factors that come into play. I've watched as people have gotten frustrated with their own individual financial situations not getting any better or struggling, that there's more people that are saying, you know, I empathize, I care, but I just have to take care of my own right now. And I've seen just a rare and care of people's patience, because although it's a small percentage of the overall population who are homeless in our community that are causing problems, I believe it's a small percentage of them. They sure don't make my job easier or anybody's job who's advocating when those things happen. And there is, I think, more of a tendency to make sure that the bad actors are getting more attention.
Any closing comments, Brad?
Yeah, because all that sounded really negative. My closing comment will be that I have absolutely loved what I've done here. I'm always going to cherish it. The people here that I work with are phenomenal people. The work's going to continue. And I still believe with all my heart that any time we get past the worst conversations and we just decide that we're going to live up to our values as people, as a community, et cetera, that's when I believe we'll be able to really make even more of a difference. And we've been making a difference here for 8 years, and I'm proud of it. We've been making a difference here long before me, and we'll make it afterwards, not just the 8 years. I was just focused on myself there for a minute.
Thank you for tuning into the KZFR 90.1 FM Without a Roof radio program. Taking you out with a little Ford promo. I'm going to be out. I'm going to be off the Without a Roof airways for a couple of weeks. Heading back. My son is getting married on the East Coast. So you'll be having some guest hosts next week's Josh Indar. And we're going to be talking about Youth Advisory Council. And then the week after that, I'm still working on it. But if you have a roof, be grateful. Guillermo Mash here, host of the Without a Roof radio program, which kicks off a trifecta of KZFR Wednesday public affairs programming, airing from 5 to 5:30.
Each week we explore poverty, the worst form of violence, focusing on human beings without a roof. Thanks for listening, and if you have a roof, be grateful. Non-Human Radio, hosted by Jeannie Fazzino, talks all things animal rights, bringing you the latest news and interviews with local activists.
Plus book, film, and restaurant reviews and deep discussions of the benefits of veganism.
For humans and non-humans alike, Wednesdays from 5:30 till 6 p.m. The Real Issue, hosted by Sue Hildebrand, digs into topics ranging from elections to environmental protection.
From social justice to economic justice, from the local to the global.
We cover the political part of everything. Wednesdays from 6 to 7 p.m.
Thanks for listening to
Pick the Power Radio.
Non-Human Radio is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the local, seasonal, and organic delights at Farm Star Pizza, where the farmer is the star. Farm Star features artisan pizzas, salad, appetizers, and desserts with vegan, oh yes, vegan, and gluten-free offerings, craft beer, and eclectic wines. Farm Star Pizza is open Monday through Friday for lunch, noon on Saturday and Sunday, and for dinner 7 nights a week with